Welcome to
America's Cannabis Conversation,
where you can hear experts from all facets of the cannabis business as to what's happening in this exploding industry. Keep yourself informed. Join the conversation. Welcome to America's Cannabis Conversation. Quick news. I'm Dan Perkins. Washington, D.C. Cory Booker cites marijuana enforcement as an example of racial injustice that is motivating the protests around the country. Senator Cory Booker, Democrat of New Jersey, is highlighting systemic social issues, including racial disparities in marijuana enforcement, that need to be addressed as people across the country march in response to the police killings as protests erupt in the wake of the Minneapolis police officers suffocating George Floyd to death, which was preceded by a fatal Louisville police shooting of Miss Taylor in a botched drug raid. Booker said it is important for people to be actively confronting the truth within our society of raising it up so there could be a deeper healing. Part of that truth is that racial disparities have long existed within the United States criminal justice system. And an example of that is the disparity enforcement of cannabis criminalization against minority community, Booker said in an interview on Friday. Denver, Colorado. Legalized marijuana boosts hotel bookings as cannabis tourism takes off, a study recently showed. Colorado hotel room rentals increased considerably after the state began legal marijuana sales, a newly published study reveals. Washington State also saw increases in tourism after legalization, though the effect there was more modest. The two states were the first in the United States to allow adult use through laws approved by voters in 2012. By comparing hotel room rentals in Colorado and Washington State that did not change their legal status of marijuana from 2011 to 2015, researchers found that legalization coincided with a significant influx of tourists and the rise of hotel revenue. The impact was even more pronounced after the start of retail sales. In both states, personal possession of marijuana was permitted for a period of time long before legal status began. Each change coincided with increases in tourism. Venice, California. Two marijuana magazines owned by High Times suspended publication due to the coronavirus. The company behind High Times is temporarily suspending the publication of two print cannabis magazines it owns due to difficulties with the supply chain that has arisen due to the coronavirus outbreak. High Times Holding Corporation confirmed on Monday. Dope Magazine and Cultural Magazines are halting circulation amid the pandemic, and six staffers across the media outlets were furloughed. Longtime High Times editor Denny Dunko also said on Monday that he was laid off, though the magazines will continue to be published. And finally, something new, quick takes. New Mexico Governor Michelle Grisham said that if lawmakers had listened to her and legalized marijuana this year, the state probably wouldn't have had to cut many programs amid the coronavirus pandemic of economic damage. The Oregon Office of Economic Analysis reports reveals that marijuana sales have skyrocketed during the coronavirus outbreak, though they're projected to drop in the future, along with population decreases. Massachusetts Legislature Joint Commission on Mental Health, Substance Abuse and Recovery approved a bill to legalize supervised consumption sites for illegal drugs. Research shows that facilities can reduce overdose and deaths. Our last story could be titled, "It's About Time." The California Assembly Business and Professionals Committee approved legalization on enforcement against illegal cannabis operations. This is Dan Perkins, and this has been your American Cannabis Conversation Quick News. So who's joining the conversation today? Well, we're going to have Phil Silverman, attorney from Boston, who's going to give us 10 tips for businesses in this post-COVID-19 era. We have a new guest, John Kaga, who is the Chief Knowledge Officer for New Frontier Data. And he joined us from Africa, and he'll deal with research findings from 6 years of cannabis use in Colorado and see how the state has changed. Another new guest on the program is the president and CEO of Zyfe Life Sciences, Brent Seidel. which is focused on advancing science of well-being. He's working on a study as to whether or not cannabis can be a treatment for COVID-19. And our favorite, America's Cannabis Conversation, cannabis doctor on call, Dr. Jordan Tischler, has a serious conversation about how his medical practice changed during the outbreak of COVID-19 and what he sees changing in the future in medicine. Let's join the conversation. Welcome back to the conversation. And today we're talking again with our attorney friend from Boston, Phil Silverman. And we're going to talk about some of the challenges, serious challenges, that a dispensary grower, anybody in the cannabis industry, especially those people who have licenses, if their dreams don't come true and now they find themselves in a situation where they have to do something about it. And I wanted to have this conversation because we have mass confusion in this industry. We have some parts of the nation that are doing extremely well and other parts of the industry that are not doing well at all. And so when you're not doing well and you're looked at, what can I do with this business? Can I sell it? Can I file for bankruptcy? So I've invited Phil to try and help us understand what my choices might be if I find my dream didn't come true. Welcome to the conversation, Phil.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
So let's talk about the issue. What happens if my dream doesn't come true? What are my options?
Sure. So there's actually quite a few options. Bankruptcy isn't necessarily off the table, although by and large, most of the courts haven't allowed companies that are actively engaged in a cannabis, sort of what we would call a plant-touching business, to file for bankruptcy and utilize those means to resolve your debts. That is available, arguably at least, to, for example, a lot of companies that have never quite gotten open, which happens to be the case with a lot of companies in various states, just because in some states the regulatory approval process is so difficult and they're spending enormous amounts of money and they never quite get to where they want to get. If you've never actually grown a plant or sold a plant, arguably a bankruptcy is available to you. But assuming that's not the case and you are sort of actively engaged with the plant, the most common resolution of your problems is what we would call just an out-of-court workout or a debt settlement. In fact, even if, you know, over a 25-year career I've had in bankruptcy, the vast majority of the people that I work with never file bankruptcy. It does help to sort of have bankruptcy as an option, almost as a threat that you can say to creditors, if I can't work this out with you, we're going to have to go to bankruptcy, and I can tell you, here's about what you can expect for a distribution based upon the amount you're owed in bankruptcy. And that's usually enough to coax them to working with you to get something a little better than that. But not always. But again, what we would do is we would sort of be fairly transparent with the creditor that you're working with and say to them, look, here's the overall situation. The assets total about this much. Here's all of the debt that's out there. And so you can expect, you know, it's a simple matter of division to tell you what you might be able to get, as a resolution if things go totally down the tubes and this company can't continue and has to somehow liquidate. Because bankruptcy isn't available, that liquidation is not going to be orderly. A lot of things could happen, but none of them are really in the creditor's interest. They involve, the debtor company spending a lot of money trying to defend in litigation, and that's just not good for creditors in general because it means assets are being devoted toward that instead of trying to keep the business alive for the benefit of creditors, and it means the attentions of the company itself are being devoted toward that as well and not focused on what it really needs to do, which is find a way to rebuild its business. So a lot of the time, by being really transparent with creditors, open about, what the situation is, they'll realize that it's in their best interest to try to work something out, whether that means taking some kind of a discount on the amount that they are owed, in order to get a sort of quick upfront cash payment, or allowing a longer term payoff of the debt that nonetheless gets them paid, everything they're owed or almost everything they're owed. There's a lot of different ways to work out those deals, but most of the time you can do that. You never end up in court. You don't need bankruptcy. You just resolve it with some kind of a settlement agreement, with a payment agreement as well. Go ahead.
Some people are saying that because of the unique nature of the business, trafficking or trading or selling in a controlled substance that's illegal at the federal level, that the federal bankruptcy rules don't apply. How do you feel about
that? And they're right. They're probably right by and large. That's what most courts have said. Most of the bankruptcy courts where companies have gone in to try to take advantage of the bankruptcy code to resolve their problems, the courts have said no, it's illegal under the Controlled Substances Act, and so those cases are summarily dismissed. And in fact, it's even worse than that. It's gotten to the point where courts have said not only, can you not file bankruptcy if you're one of the sort of plant-touching companies, but even if, for example, you're a landlord that rents to one of those companies, so that you are, in essence, receiving, your rent via a federally illegal company, those companies are also not allowed into bankruptcy. And it's really problematic because if you start to think of all of the different ways that other businesses touch a cannabis business, whether it's, mm-hmm. Because they sell inventory or supplies or, other interactions, if you're going to disallow them, the bankruptcy courts as well, you're going to find yourself disallowing an awful lot of people the relief that the bankruptcy code offers. So we're all sort of hoping for a better resolution of this, and it's probably going to take a legislative solution at the federal level to fix that, but it's not there yet. So by and large, the bankruptcy courts are not available.
If you put your answer in perspective of where we are today, many of the decisions that the courts and other organizations are going to be making are going to be making at a time when the business model of the cannabis industry is somewhat under attack. And so that we don't have any real precedent per se. How do you reorganize and restructure these companies that are trading in a controlled substance at a national level? And I'm wondering if there is an order of magnitude of the number of companies that have to seek help becomes the catalyst to bring about the change in the legal structure.
I think that's probably the case. This industry is growing at an enormous rate, and notwithstanding the economic situation we find ourselves in today, I still think that this is going to be expanding rapidly. So I think it's like any other industry, the bigger it gets, the more it seeks to influence the laws that Congress is looking at. So, and I know, there are substantial, lobbying groups that are out there trying to lobby Congress on these issues. Mm-hmm. I think, we're getting to the point where it's becoming too big an industry that Congress can sort of continue to ignore this. There's already plenty of action out there trying to get some form of legalization, even if it's not a broad federal legalization, even mm-hmm. if it's just sort of a state-by-state allowance at the federal level, of legalization. And I think once, if we can get to that point, you sort of get to a point where Congress has to realize, all right, if it's legal in that state and we're going to allow that at the federal level, then they probably need to be allowed access to the bankruptcy courts and and other types of sort of equal treatment between these types of businesses and those that are not involved in cannabis.
And even in some states where recreational marijuana is legal, it was also declared that was essential. So they're looking at this and say, wait a minute, if the governments are saying that we are an essential business to support our citizens, maybe we need to take a real hard look at these rules that are so prohibitive against us.
I think that's a natural observation. I mean, most of the states, I think did determine, it was easy for them, and there wasn't a lot of public outcry when they said that, alcohol, liquor stores and that sort of thing, were essential. On some level, a lot of people got that. Then, most states, it was a natural jump to say that, cannabis should be treated the same way. Not every state. I will tell you that Massachusetts made a distinction between the two. They tried to justify it on the basis that it had the potential to bring in visitors from other states nearby that had not legalized adult use marijuana. And that was the basis they used for distinguishing. But I think most people see it in the same way. It's something of a comfort for people. And so once you get to that point and you get states acknowledging it, you would think it wouldn't be that long before there was some understanding that we need to start treating these businesses like every other business we deal with, whether from a tax standpoint or from a standpoint of allowing access to bankruptcy courts and such. So I think it's inevitable and we're getting there. We all hope it'll happen a lot more quickly.
Yeah, you raised in the minute or two we have left, you raised an important issue, and that is the tax revenue. In many cases, there are now people are saying that the acceptance of cannabis through both recreational and medical dispensaries now in over 30 states can be a source of revenue to assist the states in recovery. And they're actually saying that they believe that it will probably be expansionary in that the ability of the states, which have been very restrictive in many cases, tend to be more lenient to allow more dispensaries to be opened within a specific boundary. You know, you just mentioned that people were coming into Massachusetts from border states that weren't legal.
Yep.
That's an issue. And I'm curious what you think about that.
Well, I think it's true. It's interesting, because as I mentioned to you before, part of my job these days is to go to local communities and try to get them to allow my clients to operate there. And, it varies from city to city and town to town, how willing they are to do that. But I think my job is easier now, quite frankly, because on some level, when the economy, is really humming along, it's not as easy as a sell to explain the economic benefits of these types of businesses, the number of jobs that you can, provide people at a cultivation facility, for example, which, is pretty substantial in the grand scheme of things. Well, when the economy is not humming along, yet you still have an industry that's expanding like this one is, it's probably going to make my job easier to convince these people, look, you don't want to be you don't want to see these revenues going to every surrounding town around you when you're rejecting it.
Right.
I don't think your residents are going to be very happy under those circumstances.
Well, unfortunately, Phil, we were out of time. Thank you for joining us. We've been speaking with Phil Silverman. And please tell our audience how they can get in touch with you and follow you and your firm.
You bet. The law firm is Vicente Cederberg. We're a national cannabis law firm operating in really every state that's legalized right now. And our website is VicenteCederberg.com. And feel free to click on there, check it out, and give me a call if you have any other questions.
Super. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. Pleasure.
You're listening to America's Cannabis Conversation on W420RadioNetwork.com. Your new cannabis electronic checking account can offer you PIN secure credit and debit cards for your clients. We can place a cashless ATM at your checkout counter, which reduces the amount of cash on hand. Did you know that we can help you bring legacy cash into your new cannabis electronic checking account? No more paying with cash. Making payments with your electronic check is safe and secure. So if you find yourself up at night worrying about somebody breaking in and stealing your cash, consider a cannabis electronic checking account. To find out if a cannabis electronic checking account is right for you, call 888-420-8884 and ask for Dan Perkins. That's 888-420-8844. W420RadioNetwork.com.
Welcome back to The Conversation, and join us from Nairobi is John Kegya, who is the Chief Knowledge Officer for New Frontier Data. This is an organization that collects data and provides research, extensive research on the cannabis industry. John, thank you for joining us from Africa today.
It's an absolute pleasure, Dan. Thank you for having us.
So let's start off with a report that you did that looked at 6-year anniversary of recreational cannabis in the state of Colorado. What did you learn, John?
Quite a number of things in looking at how Colorado's market has evolved since legal sales began in January of 2014. First, the adult use market, the recreational market, has performed extraordinarily well. So over the past 6 years, over $5.5 billion of cannabis products have been sold to consumers in Colorado. And when you combine the medical and the adult use market, you have sales totaling nearly $8 billion. So this has been a phenomenal kind of revenue generating opportunity, not just for the businesses that are operating in the state, but also for the state. So, you know, Colorado's tax rate, which is a little under 30%, and that's the combined taxes that customers are paying in total when they purchase products, has allowed the state to earn over $1 billion in taxes over that period. And this combination of this market not only being a significant source of new economic opportunity for entrepreneurs who have been able to create a lot of wealth, a lot of jobs, but also for the state, which has been able to find this new, completely untapped source of tax revenue, I think has been just strong affirmation that cannabis legalization is a real catalyst both for economic development as well as for government revenue growth.
So, John, let me follow up that with another question. In 2019, we saw about a 63% decline in the price of cannabis stocks, and we started off 2020 with almost another 40% down. And there are a lot of people now saying that that capital is almost non-existent. So a lot of people who got in the business 6 years ago didn't have the vision, nor did anybody have the vision to see the coronavirus, number one. But number two, didn't see the 60% decline in the price of their stocks because of expansion. So we now have a shortage, apparently what appears to be a shortage of capital, at least in some parts of the country. How is this affecting the growth potential in Colorado?
So that's a really important question, and there's a number of convergent forces there that I think are important to unpack before we can talk about what the future is. So just first trying to understand how we got to where we are. Why did we mm-hmm. have such a dramatic decline in market values in 2019? Well, mm-hmm. to put it bluntly, there was, and to quote Alan Greenspan, there was a lot of irrational exuberance mm-hmm. in cannabis. So a lot of investors who put a lot of capital into this market at supercharged valuations with very dramatic or with very kind of short-term expectations about how quickly the growth would be achieved without really an intimate understanding of how the business, the economics, and the market of cannabis works. So the valuations that were being placed on these particularly large Canadian publicly traded companies, but it also bled over to the U.S. side, was based on really unrealistic expectations of how quickly the markets would catalyze the growth needed to return value that reflected these very lofty expectations. And let's use Canada as a good example of this. There's a lot of pomp and circumstance about Canada being the first developed nation to legalize cannabis. But what a lot of people weren't looking at was actually how that process was being effected. There were major regulatory delays in getting that market up and running. There were very strict rules around which products could be sold, including, you know, in the first year of operations, you couldn't sell anything other than flower or, broadly speaking, a flower-only market. And third, beyond what was happening at the national level, even at the kind of local jurisdictional level, within the provinces, a lot of businesses took a lot longer to get operational than had been expected. So when investors were plowing money into these Canadian LPs, driving up their valuations to, you know, $40 billion, it was with the expectation, one, that the Canadian market would be up and running virtually overnight, and then two, that these Canadian companies would go global and set up markets in Europe, in Latin America, in Asia Pacific, specifically in Australia, potentially in New Zealand, without really understanding how long it actually takes to activate a market and to get that market operating in a normalized fashion. And so with people expecting, you know, immediate term returns in 1 or 2 years for a roadmap 5, 6, 7 years to fully manifest, it's meant that, you know, in 2018, a lot of investors started having that moment of sobriety, realizing, yes, the market opportunity is still there, but it's going to take a much longer time to achieve that level of growth. And so you saw that market pullback. The market fundamentals remain the same. You know, cannabis demand, as we can see from Colorado, remains very strong. Consumer demand, even in a COVID environment, has actually been catalyzed, has actually increased, not declined. We know that cannabis, based on every other market contraction, is actually relatively recession-proof, and that consumers will keep spending even as the economic circumstances may tighten. So the market fundamentals remain strong. But what I think investors need to understand is that due to regulations, due to the time required to operationalize the market, these markets don't catalyze overnight. And as we can see in Colorado, it's taken 6 years for the legal market to cannibalize 80% of the total demand in the state. So if at the beginning of 2014, nearly 100% of the state's demand was being served by the illicit market, 6 years later, we're seeing that the legal market has now captured 80% of that demand. So for the people who thought that a market like Canada was going to overnight somehow completely consume all of the demand that was being served by the previously illicit market, we know from Colorado that it takes time to get there. It does get there, but you've got to factor that growth period into your outlook for this market opportunity.
John, do you think that this correction would have happened in the cannabis market and continue into 2020, regardless of the coronavirus-19?
Absolutely. And to your point, the fact that we'd already seen such a dramatic correction pre-COVID indicates that, you know, this market was already due for a correction. It's something that we have been talking about now for 2 or 3 years, saying that, you know, some of these valuations just did not reflect the practical realities of how long it was going to take the market to achieve its full potential. Not that the market is not going to achieve that potential, but it is going to take time, particularly to understand how some of these larger markets are being regulated. You know, so the correction would have happened pre-COVID. COVID has been an additional catalyst. However, we think that the contraction that we saw at the beginning of the COVID pandemic did not account for, one, cannabis businesses being declared essential in most parts of the country, and two, the increase in demand that we have seen as a function of people now being home, at home and spending more on cannabis. And so we actually think that there's some investors who may have pulled out of the market at the initial part of this COVID pandemic who are now revisiting this market because they actually see that this is one of the few sectors of the economy that has continued to outperform even amidst this much broader economic roiling that we're seeing.
Well, John, unfortunately, we're out of time for this segment, but I want you to tell people how they can reach you and follow your company. So please give us an email or our web address, please.
Thank you. You can reach us at newfrontierdata.com. That's newfrontierdata.com, where you can find access to not only the research that we've done in Colorado, but all of the research that we've done around the THC market, the CBD market, and industrial hemp around the world. We provide a lot of resources to investors, business owners, lawmakers, and regulators, and hope you'll take advantage of all of the intelligence we provide.
Super. John, thank you for joining us today.
Introducing the new Cannabis Electronic Checking Account. Did you know that in 2019, almost one in five dispensaries were either robbed or broken into? Your business is cash only, because up to now, you didn't have access to a banking account that would allow you to deposit the daily receipts from your business. Some owners have started a banking relationship only to be told in a few months that the institution was closing the account. For the first time, you can now have a reliable business checking account. Yes, I said a secure bank electronic checking account. For more information, call 1-888-420-8844 and ask for Dan Perkins. That's 888-420-8884 and ask for Dan Perkins. W420RadioNetwork.com.
Welcome back to the conversation. And joining us today again is Brent Zeidel from Zaius Life Sciences, who is studying how cannabis might lead to a possible treatment or virus for COVID-19. And we want to spend a little bit of time understanding his company and what other things they're doing. So, Brent, welcome to the conversation.
Thank you.
Tell us about Zaius Life Sciences.
So Zaius Life Sciences is a life sciences company that's focused on advancing the science of well-being. And so the rise of our company, or the mission, came out of the fallout from what was from CannaMed days, when we had, after the hostile takeover in 2018. And we wanted to, we saw at that time, after spending 18 years in the business, that there was a true medical component to cannabis usage for people who are suffering in what we see in the two main groups of chronic and neuropathic pain, which was 58% of our population, and another group which we call in neuropsychiatry, which is anxiety, depression, and PTSD. Mm. And we said they were using very different varieties that had a different profile of cannabinoid profile, and we were able to track them. And so what we said after we were done, and there was no non-competes, myself and then 35 members of my team came across, and we started the Zaius Life Sciences 3 days later with the mission to really advance the science of well-being, to find the truth behind this cannabinoid formulation and how it's really benefiting people's lives. And so what we wanted to do is move it from what I would call anecdotal information, our observing of our patients, into a clinical setting. And that's what we started to do.
We have a situation here, Brent, in the United States where the data that we're getting about cannabis and the treatment of pain is when people who are purchasing cannabis, whether at a recreational or medical dispensary in the United States, why are they purchasing it? The number one answer, almost 60% of the time, is pain.
Right.
And we're looking at it from the standpoint that we have a much older population than most people would believe that are using cannabis for pain, because they have rejected the alternative pain medications, which didn't work, made them sicker, and they're desperately looking for an alternative. Did you find any of that evidence in what you were doing?
Absolutely. The key thing that 58% of the patients that we had, which was 48,000 patients, we're using for managing chronic and neuropathic pain. And when we started unveiling, unfolding the sort of the data, it looks like in Canada, 1 in 4 Canadians suffer in either neuropathic or chronic pain. In the United States, it's north of 50 million Americans daily suffer with chronic pain. And when you look at the spectrum of pain treatments, you know, you have the NSAIDs or the, you know, Tylenol Advils of the world, or and you have the then a dearth, and then there's the opiates. And everybody moves immediately. If once they're done using ibuprofen or the like, ASA, they move into the doctors, start prescribing opiates, which have been a real, real problem. And I think there's a big challenge in knowing that the cannabinoids have been artificially disallowed to progress as a medicine. And we're just unlocking the potential. And where a cannabis treatment or a cannabis-based treatment fits for chronic pain is, in my mind, is right in between the either as first line or second line behind the NSAIDs and before the opiates. That's where I think it really belongs, and there's compelling evidence. In 1937, 28% of all medications in the doctor's toolkit prior to prohibition were cannabis-based. And the prohibition, when prohibition came in, it wiped out 28% of the medications at that time. But there was good reason they were using it. And now it's only now after 80-some years that we're realizing that we're really missing the advantage in medicine of using a proper cannabis-based medicine. And I think we'll find that as we unleash the sort of the clinical evidence of this, it's going to become much more commonplace for people to rely on this, not just for managing pain, but for things such as anxiety, depression, and PTSD. There's compelling evidence already that it's being used, but I think we our mission as a company is to prove it out.
I have seen and done a number of interviews with researchers like yourself who complain, is a fair word, that the regulation of cannabis has cost us years of research that we could have progressed through to have natural products dealing with more and more of the issues that we suffer as human beings. And we're still way behind the ball. There's still a lot of people. The cannabis alternative to opioids, I've done many, many interviews with people who were addicted to opioids, who used cannabis to get off of the opioids and go on to live a normal life. And so I think you're right. There needs to be more time, energy, and money put in the research. And I guess my question to you as a research organization, why is it so slow? Is the money and the regulations slow to come about?
Well, the regulations, you know, in Canada, we're allowed to do the research, but I can tell you everything after 20 years of history in this file, working with the cannabis plant and the cannabis for therapy, has been a headwind. It has been difficult. Because it's illegally in most other countries on a national scale, every time you touch cannabis and doesn't even make it on the schedule, everybody doesn't want to deal with this. The banks don't want to touch it. It's got the stigma attached to it with respect to what it really means, et cetera, et cetera. So everything we do is like 10 orders of magnitude more difficult regulatory-wise and research-wise because it's not a normal, commonplace thing. And the fact that it's still a Schedule I drug in the United States at a federal level makes it doubly hard to do any kind of thing because the rest of the world takes their cue from the United States on this kind of matters. Now, in Canada, they went the other way with the recreational side, but it's still, when it comes to medicine, we have our schedule type of discipline. We have to go through it. So if you look at the cannabis space right now, the confusing part that we're in these times is that there's really three markets emerging using the same plant. There's a recreational market that's used on an exemptive basis in some states at a state level, but not still a Schedule I that's untouchable at a federal level in the United States. In Canada, it's turned recreational, but there still is a recreational market that's been legalized in Canada, but it's a rec market. Then there's a natural health products market, which tries to pull out different cannabinoids other than THC. Everybody knows THC, that it gets high, but Dial or CBD is the one that the natural health products people are trying to use in everything from, you know, power aid drinks to whatever to manage anxiety and to manage depression. But it's coming from the hemp guy. The hemp producers can also produce it. The third group is really the true medical group. And the true medical group has got to drill down, and it's like GW Pharmaceuticals, it's the things that are produced for Epidiolex. It's stuff that's proven with the clinical evidence that it's for a specific type of combination of cannabinoids that are the active ingredients like THC and CBD, then they work in concert in a certain way to treat at a certain dose to treat a certain condition. You got to just prove that out. And I think there's been a lot of confusion between the three markets and a lot of confusion about what to do next in terms of what research, because, and here's the funny part, the irony. When we did the test for, when we sort of looked at analysis, when we had the 48,000 patients, when we looked at how many conditions that people were using cannabis for, it was over 350 different conditions. People were managing, using cannabis to manage their condition. So what the problem you have is that you have, all of a sudden it's just like, wow, what do we pick as a target to discipline, to show the discipline in the science? Because there's so many different people that are using it for so many different things, which speaks to the fact that there's a tremendous unmet need.
Mm-hmm.
So to the point where we're saying, okay, we need to move the needle on the science. We have compelling anecdotal evidence. This plant has been around for 4,000 years at least in documented history. It doesn't appear to be too dangerous because we don't have our hospitals overrun with people dying of overdose of cannabis. It doesn't. In between the United States and Canada, there hasn't been a single person die from a natural cannabis plant that we know of of an overdose. We even tried to find an LD50 for rats, and that LD50, meaning 50% of the weight that kills, you know, a mammal system, right? Mm-hmm. We couldn't get there. The rats just got comfortable and went to sleep. Couldn't even get an LD50 on the cannabis plant. So it's relatively benign is what I'm trying to get at compared to an opiate. But still, the science is missing in terms of what do we got to do, what are the doses that we have to do. And I think the time is coming where then that's what we're driving towards, where we're going to have some meaningful data, clinical data, that points to this combination of cannabinoids that'll treat certain things. And it's funny because one formulation to treat pain is completely different than the one that treats PTSD.
I think the fact that our federal government refuses to even allow it to be used as a medical or a nutritional supplement keeps the progress down. But there are people like you and your organizations that continue to do the research that build compelling stories.
I think the key thing here is going to be we're going to unleash the truths about it in the comedies. I think the truth of the matter is it's more complicated than you know, when we think about a single drug for a single condition. It appears to us that this has at least two, possibly three cannabinoids work better together than any one or two apart, like by themselves. And so the complicating part is that we know there's our receptors. We know there's at least two receptors. There's a theory that there's much more than that in the what we're calling the natural endocannabinoid system, which means that's why we react to it. And so we already know two receptors. We also know that the ion channels are involved. And so from a science perspective, we know that the cannabinoids, there's too many things that they touch within the human system, but they're touching a lot at the same time. And that's mm-hmm. what makes it complicated. So we know that at least seven different active cannabinoids are active in the human being. So THC is one, CBD is another, cannabigerol, cannabichromine as examples, right? They're all mm-hmm. functioning where they have an impact on the human being. And so right. The challenge is really finding that combination that really addresses our understanding addresses the condition. And science is now bioinformatics. I mean, we have an AI-enabling platform for doing the clinical trials. We'll be setting up people with Fitbits and for, you know, cell phone apps so they can dial in their progress and how they're doing in the clinical trials, that kind of thing, so we can get to real-world evidence faster. So we're really trying to speed up the process of getting information. But that's what's needed to really change the needle. And the medical community is resistant. They've been they only want to see data. They don't want to see, you know, anecdotal evidence. One little footnote I would make is that on our patients, we would get between 12 and 20 spontaneous responses a day on our patient group. And it was really compelling because very often a patient who has found the right formulation that changed their life. Either they got to managing their MS, or they're managing their chronic pain of some kind, or managing their anxiety, would come out and say, you know, under our doctor's supervision, when we found the right regime we were using in your products, we found that we were able to reduce our prescription drugs 50 to 80%.
Yeah, it's amazing.
To me was a telltale sign that their quality of life improved, their family life improved, and they were able to actually then reduce their other prescription drugs, but at the same time, so it was cheaper and better. And so I think this is, from my standpoint, given the opiate crisis, this is a perfect storm why we need cannabinoids to become in their prominent place where they belong in pain management, ahead of the opiates and behind the NSAIDs.
Wonderful. Well, unfortunately, Brett, we're out of time. As I anticipated this to be a terrific interview, you just did a wonderful job of helping us understand a whole raft of information about what you're trying to do as a company. And we've been speaking to Brent Zeitel of Zias Life Sciences. And I would like you to let people know how they can follow what's going on with your company.
Sure. You can track us on Zyus.com, so the Zyus.com, and we'll put all of our press releases and anything we're doing on the progress of the company on there.
I would love to have you back on the show again, because I'm fascinated in what you're doing in research, and I applaud you for what you're doing, and maybe you're going to save some lives. Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you, Dan.
You're welcome. We'll be right back.
America's newest and fastest growing cannabis-focused radio network is expanding across the country and looking to add to our sales and marketing team. America's Cannabis Conversation offers listeners insight and information on the exploding world of cannabis. It also gives advertisers the opportunity to reach a hyper-targeted audience, literally neighborhood by neighborhood, in markets all across the country. We're looking for a few motivated individuals that want to essentially run their own local business in markets like Boston, Las Vegas, Reno, Orlando, and more. To learn more about this exciting opportunity or to apply, visit americascannabisconversation.com. Want to find out if cannabis can help your medical condition? It's time to hear from our cannabis doctor on call.
Welcome back to the conversation. Joining us today is our expert, our cannabis doctor on call. I've asked Dr. Jordan Tischler to join us today because he's going to be able to give us firsthand experience of a medical practitioner who was trying to keep his practice going and serving people's needs during this pandemic. Dr. Jordan, thank you for joining us today.
Always my pleasure to be here.
So let's talk about what it was like for Dr. Jordan Tischler to come through the last 4 months in a practice in the state of Massachusetts where medical marijuana is legal. What happened to your practice and in your practice over the last 4 months?
It's been very interesting. So one of the first things was that when things started to get rocky, I very quickly moved the practice to an all telehealth, all online approach. I had been using telehealth here and there along the way for several years, and really had the feeling that it was, okay, but not as good as seeing people face to face. But under the circumstances, I wanted to be able to provide care to people, and we needed to do it that way. So we did it. And now that I've been at this for a while, I actually think that there are some advantages to telehealth. I not only can I reach sort of a broader geographic area, but it's also something very nice about seeing people in their comfortable home environment. I had a patient who I saw a few weeks ago. She was sitting in her kitchen. She seemed very relaxed. We were having a good conversation about what she needs to accomplish for her health. And then her 5-year-old crawled into her lap and wanted a snuggle. And I thought that was lovely. You don't you know, it's a little bit like making house calls in the old days, you know. Mm-hmm. You really get to know people in a different way that way. And so actually I've really come to appreciate the telemedicine approach and actually are now lobbying for this to become a more permanent option for doing this business.
If you look at a telemedicine call versus an office call, is there a difference in time?
No, not at least the way I'm doing it. It's, you know, I spend an hour with every initial visit, so it's pretty much the same thing, and I'm using the same materials. You know, when people come to the office physically, I would be giving them this sort of green folder with a bunch of pages in it that we would then go through in the office to talk about all the various topics, which was good because that way, you know, people go home with something they've seen before when I talked about it with them, but then they could refresh their memory and kind of let it sink in. And it also made sure that I didn't forget anything important in the process. And so I've just simply turned all of those pages into a PDF that I email people after we start our telehealth conversation. And then we open them up and go through them together just like that. So it really is basically the same kind of a visit in terms of the logistics.
If you were seeing, before the pandemic, you were seeing 20 patients a day in person. During the pandemic, what did it drop to?
Oh, 15? It didn't drop at all. No, I mean, we're still seeing exactly the same number of patients per day, or maybe slightly higher because we've sort of been sort of shoehorned. I mean, the demand for appointments went up, which is really to your point about this epidemic, this second epidemic of anxiety and depression and PTSD that we're seeing. There's tremendous demand, and so we have been seeing more patients rather than fewer patients.
So you've been buried.
Yeah, I mean, not in a bad way. It hasn't been I mean, you know, one could imagine you could have an influx that was, you know, greater than your capacity, and you were harried and trying to do it all and take care of all these patients, and it hasn't been that bad, but we've certainly seen an increase in demand. And it's been interesting here in Massachusetts. You had mentioned in a previous comment about, you know, the states that have deemed medical to be a necessary service. And that most of the studies, the states that also had recreational had deemed that to be necessary. Massachusetts was the only state that said, no, medical is necessary, but recreational is not necessary. And so I think that that has contributed a little bit to the uptick in people coming to see me, that who were previously using cannabis in a sort of medical self-treatment kind of fashion. But who could no longer do that. So it's been very interesting for us to try to figure out, well, you know, who's a stoner who just wants to get their card because suddenly they've been cut off versus who is out there who is using this absolutely legitimately for medical use, not necessarily the best way, but their purpose was the right one. And how do we help those people understand and get better benefit? And what I've seen so far, is a huge percentage of the people coming in from that recreational market have, in fact, got legitimate medical problems and actually can really benefit from medical guidance. And I think that most of the people who've then come to me and received that guidance have recognized the value there. And so it gets really to the point of, you know, within this industry, there's a very big push towards treating everybody as though they were recreational because it lets the dispensaries sell a lot of product, which I can totally understand. But in reality, for people who have illnesses, lots of product and lots of different products is not usually all that helpful. It leads to overuse and confusion and not getting the best result. Whereas if we have something that's a little bit more buttoned down and a little bit more like the sort of conventional medical system that after all evolved over 100 years to be, you know, on, based on best practices. This allows us to be able to really help people and to really use this stuff in a way that, that kind of cuts right to the chase and gets people the benefit that they're looking for.
Doctor, what percentage do you think of your practice today is telehealth?
No, it's 100% right now.
100% of your practice is telehealth.
100%. I haven't seen a single human being in the office since the early March. But
wow.
So it's all telehealth. And we're sort of still working out some of the kinks around which telehealth providers are the best. But it's all been telehealth. Yep.
Yeah. Wow. Do you expect that will be your practice of the future, or will you begin to see people come back to the office?
You know, that's a great question. And part of the answer to that is that in Massachusetts, as with many other states, there are requirements built into the law that governs medical cannabis that require an inpatient, an in-person visit, you know, every so often, and typically annually. Quite frankly, I think that there are political reasons for that stipulation in the law, having to do with concerns about unscrupulous practitioners not really seeing or taking care of people and just kind of doling out the cards. But
right.
And so some safeguards around that issue probably are appropriate, but I'm not sure that this is the right way to address the issue. And frankly, if we were able to change that policy so that we could continue using telehealth, I think that would actually be a good thing. It doesn't mean I would never see anybody in person, but it would give me the flexibility. I mean, Massachusetts is a tiny state compared to most. However, it's still 2.5 hours across, and I have patients who come literally from the far end of Massachusetts, 2.5 hours, to see me because there really aren't any other people practicing the kind of medicine that I practice. And so, you know, if they're really sick and they really, really need a real doctor to help them with this, there aren't that many to choose from. And I'm working on fixing that. But
right,
but it means that the sickest people are the ones who have to schlep all the way across the state, whereas
right.
if they were to allow me to use telemedicine going forward, I can see them in their home, you know, and that makes it easier for them. And that's a plus.
So with the patients that you're seeing now over the last 4 months, is people dealing with depression and anxiety a significant portion of what you're seeing?
Oh, without question, I would say maybe about 25%. And prior to COVID, I would say it was maybe 20%. I mean, so there's definitely a bump up, you know, it's not an astronomical bump up. And I think that if we can reframe this period of time going forward as just kind of this is the way it's going to be for a while until we get this better under control, meaning a vaccine or something like that, I think then the anxiety and stuff will kind of calm down. Right now, where everyone is so, like, let's reopen, and everybody is so focused on what they've lost from the pre-COVID time, that's the setup for anxiety. And, you know, once we kind of move past that and start to understand ourselves as being in a new era, I'm hopeful that some of this anxiety will abate.
There's a reason why we have you on the show, because you're really that good, and I appreciate the time you've given us today. Thank you for joining us today, Doctor, and we look forward to having you on again soon. How can people follow you or get in touch with you?
Thank you so much for the kind words and the opportunity to speak to people. If people want to get in touch, they can always go to my website, which is inhalemd.com. Again, inhalemd.com, where they'll find lots and lots of articles on cannabis for various topics and various illnesses, and they can always reach out to me through the website as well.
Thank you. We've been talking to our cannabis conversation doctor on call, Dr. Jordan Tischler. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for taking part in America's Cannabis Conversation. To hear this show in its entirety or to hear any of our archive shows, log on to americascannabisconversation.com and tune in next Saturday at 4:20 p.m. for the next installment of America's Cannabis Conversation.
America's Cannabis Conversation.